Who is that?
Jazz.
Bastard.
All right. Well, are we ready here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know I should probably figure out what number this is. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 135. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
Neither of us have cool names like Dippermouth or Satchmo. We're just ordinary dudes. But today we're going to talk a little bit about one of this, I guess, lesser known phases of Louis Armstrong's career. I love Armstrong. I sometimes think he's the most important jazz musician that I listen the least to at some level. I don't often pull his stuff out. I don't know if that's true for you, or at least as often as I feel I should.
I probably listen to more than you do. There's usually some Armstrong in the rotation somewhere, usually.
And I guess it's mainly just because so much of his stuff has vocals. And then
Right. There's
just so fucking much of his stuff.
Yeah.
I've got a bit of a trawl here, but I'm a piker. You know, I was looking around, and the authoritative discography seems to be at a place called michaelmin.net. So I guess it's a guy named Michael Min is the one that assembled it, but it's very, very thorough. And then there's this guy apparently based in Sweden from the suffix, but dippermouth.blogspot.se. And by God, he'll talk about a song from the Hot Fives recordings and then discuss, you know, all 30 recordings Louis Armstrong made of it later in life in detail, analyzing each performance. It's just kind of insane.
Yeah, we should start this by saying that while we're going to talk about a certain period, the fact is, among jazz literati, those who are deep into Armstrongiana, I think that's a word, I just made it up, are really deep into it. I mean, these are people who analyze based on the ambient sound of one take versus another, who the recording engineer was. And this is a rabbit hole you can disappear down on the internet pretty quickly. So we're not going to approach these things at anything like that level of specificity or detail. We're going to have a more sort of global, ears open approach. But if you want that kind of take, it's available in many, many places. There are people who live for this stuff.
Yeah, like Ellington, he's just kind of to me, the difference would be is that, and I think I'm trying to get to what I love the guy. And I mean, I've really enjoyed listening to this stuff, and I'll probably go back to putting more of it in my diet. You know, it is fantastic. But I think as kind of a jazz fan that came to the music later, and of course, people younger than us, of whom are growing every day, come to it later yet, I'm just thinking about the barriers, I guess, for the ordinary Joe jazz bow on the street to kind of getting into Louis the way you might decide you want to get into Miles Davis or John Coltrane. And I think one of them is this huge discography of, you know, there's just a lot of repetition in it, right? Lots. I mean, the All-Stars were an ongoing unit for like 20 years or more, and their set list wasn't that long. And there's just hundreds, it seems like, recordings of things. And then, you know, it's the style. Obviously, he is kind of I tend to think of jazz orthodoxy as seeing modern jazz from the 50s as being kind of the watershed. And that's sort of where a lot of people's appreciation of the music begins. I don't know. Maybe I'm over-exaggerating it. I mean, clearly there are pockets of people that love the earlier styles, but it's my general feeling. I don't know.
And, well, the other thing to say is if you get interested in any of this from us talking, there is no need to go out and avail yourself of the many box sets. I mean, if you want to, you can. There's a shit ton of box sets of Louis Armstrong, a varying quality, but generally pretty good, and some insanely well documented. But he is perhaps the most well documented player on the internet. So if you want to hear 10 different cuts of I'm Confessing That I Love You, you can find them. You can YouTube them. They're available. And there will be people, you know, debating, well, this Decacide isn't as good as that earlier Hot Fives take, you know, whatever. You know, if you want to get into them at a sort of an album-by-album level, which is how most of us got into music when we were younger because we came of age in the age of albums, that's less available in a sense, right? I mean, he recorded all these things as singles, two side 78s. So it's not until later in his career that he overlaps with the era of the album. But if you just want to hear this stuff, man, it's out there. YouTube is insanely full of this stuff. And you can find multiple cuts, multiple takes from different years with different units. And oftentimes the people who comment on these YouTube videos will say, no, Louis Russell wasn't the leader of that date, or that trombone player isn't so-and-so. So you can find that. You can find it. It's just, it's not the traditional method that, say, people of our age, you know, initially got into music, you know, through albums. That's not how you find your way into Armstrong, unfortunately, or fortunately.
And I guess I should just state that what we kind of decided to do for this episode at my request was just to focus on a box that I got years ago, issued by, I believe, now defunct Spanish label called Definitive, of Louis's Decasides from 1935 to 1939. And I was thinking, well, is this going to be the kind of music you can listen to streaming? And it turns out that Verve, who apparently absorbed that catalog at some point, and of course itself is part of a larger conglomerate, has just released a 6 quote-unquote CD set called the Decca Singles 35 through 46. And I think it reproduces, I've got another 2 CD set that covers that later period. It kind of reproduces that era. It's only digital. They didn't make discs, but you can buy the MP3s from Amazon. If you really wanted to own the music, you can stream it on Spotify, and luckily it's recent enough that it comes up pretty quickly. There's a later collection of Decca singles out there from 49 to 58, and so it's a weird terminology, because really what they mean are just the things he recorded for Decca. As Mike was saying, these were 78. They were all singles. There weren't any albums. So it's just everything that he did in that span of time, which is roughly 5 hours of music from 35 to 39. And just roughly speaking, if you've never listened to Louis Armstrong, I don't know, would you agree that you begin with the Hot Fives and Sevens? I guess that's certainly what I...
Yeah, absolutely. You have to. So if you want to understand why he's important and what's essential, you start with the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens. The stuff he recorded right after he left King Oliver, that stuff changed the world. I don't think that's too much. I don't think that's an overstatement. It changed the jazz world. It changed everything. And as much as I hate to agree with Wynton Marsalis and his neo-traditionalist agenda, I mean, the fact is, if you don't know that music, you really need to. It's just essential. You know, if there's a Mount Rushmore of jazz, not sure who maybe the third and fourth figures are, but Louis Armstrong is George Washington. I mean, he's just it. He's just, you have to know that stuff, and you need to start with the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens to hear just why he was so important. This stuff is already after he's world famous and comfortable in some ways, but, you know, honing his craft as a showman and as a performer in different kinds of ways, and really building his resume as a vocalist, which that's finally what he's known as at the end of his career, when his chops are gone. He's still an insanely charismatic and compelling vocalist. But yeah, you got to start with Hot Fives and Hot Sevens. Those are very widely available. You can get them as single CDs. You can get them as, you know, collect. You can get the complete Hot Fives, Hot Sevens. I think I have the single CDs myself, but they are the Rosetta Stone of jazz. And then who are the other figures on the Mount Rushmore? Ellington. Ellington's Abraham Lincoln, right? And then,
probably,
Miles Davis is Thomas Jefferson. I don't know. And then who gets to be Teddy Roosevelt?
Well, honestly, you know, I think some people might put Coltrane there first. I don't know. And the other thing I'd be curious about, if we have any younger listeners, we may not, is just growing up when we did as kids in the 70s, everybody knew who Louis Armstrong was. I mean, Armstrong dies like 71 or something, but his cultural profile was as a mass market entertainer and vocalist and the guy that sang Hello Dolly, etc. But I mean, he was just universally known. And I don't know whether now, if you grew up, say, 2 or 3 decades later, that's the case. I don't know whether that aspect of his career has kind of faded and now he's kind of gone back to the jazz enthusiasts, or whether he's still kind of known as a world cultural figure. I just don't know.
Yeah, there was a time when he you know, we think of Ellington as the ambassador for jazz and for American values during those during the heyday years when he and the band are touring. But it was Armstrong first. Armstrong's music made it to England really early, and he became lionized overnight. And he was a worldwide cultural ambassador extremely early in his career. He stood for America. I mean, he was a world figure relatively early in his career. By the 30s, he's a world figure. By the early 30s, and some might argue even sooner. His importance at one time culturally was monumental. He was, you name it, the Michael Jordan, the Michael Jackson of his day. That's probably less true now. I mean, he's a figure that people know of, but he doesn't have that same penetration into mass markets and pop culture that he did at a certain time when everyone knew who he was. Everyone knew his music or had heard his music, and they knew the name. They knew what he did. So that's probably different.
You know, and he's got this problematic, as we do the macro look, and then we'll focus in a little bit sooner on this.
Sure.
Period where musically he begins to seem retrograde to people after the bebop revolution. And then socially or politically, people criticize him for not being as vocal as he should have been about black struggles and black rights and for doing some performances that people saw as Uncle Tomming. There are certainly a couple of problematic tracks on this. For the most part, not, but my favorite core of this music, which I heard before I heard the rest of it, is the stuff he does with the Mills Brothers. And I think they're just amazing performances. I love them. But a couple of the tunes they sing are problematic. They sing about darkies and missing massa. And this is like, holy shit. Anyway, so he's got that problem. And I guess, you know, the light biographies I've read, and anybody could look up the same, is just that we think of it the mid late 20s. He's doing these amazing Hot 5, Hot 7s. He's not the first jazz soloist. He's not the first important jazz trumpeter. Blah. He's just the guy that kind of is a proof of concept, right? He's the one that just makes this seem inevitable and inescapable and the highest of art, right, when he starts playing. And then he goes to Europe tours and apparently blows his lip. He had troubles with his lip off and on, takes some time off, and he comes back and he's kind of at loose ends in the mid-30s. And then this guy named Joe Glazer takes over his career, guy with mob connections, and gets him this Decca contract, and he's back, you know, in the saddle, in the spotlight.
I'm in the mood for love, simply because you're near me. Oh, funny when you're near me. I'm in the mood for love, heaven is in your eyes. Bright as the stars under, oh, is it any wonder? Oh, baby, I'm the moon love.
And it's, you know, one of the, I've kind of thought about genres of song on this, because what we're talking about here is a lot of individual tracks, 5 hours worth. It's kind of overwhelming. And it's interesting, by this period in the mid-30s, he is doing remakes of some of the Hot 5, Hot 7 material. I mean, it's literally, they're nostalgic about Dixieland 10 years later. As we look at it from almost 100 years later, it's just hard to get your mind around that it was such a artistic explosion, so important to people that even as the swing era got underway, people were looking back fondly and remembering the stuff he did just 10 years earlier and just thinking it was important enough to recreate it.
Yeah, we should, maybe that's a way to start to ease out of macro into micro issues is, I think one of the things we need to talk about here, Armstrong's influence as someone who took Dixieland and made it jazz, that's the early narrative, and his trip from New Orleans to Chicago is revolutionary when he gets to Chicago and starts recording, and you know that's the beginning of the music for many people. But I think one of the stories of these sides that we're looking at, and by the way, class, this disc set that Pat's talking about that we're looking at, you're not going to find, it's hard to find the exact one we're looking at. Just look for the Decca recordings from the 30s. That's really what we're talking about today.
The latest package is that Decca singles, as they so-called.
Right, right.
And that is more or less the first four groupings or discs of that is reproducing what we're talking about here. So, you know, God bless Verve. They happened to decide this was the time to release that because it was hard to track down. Anyway, and certainly the package we listened to is long gone. I really wonder if it was dubs from the Mosaic set or whether they did their own legwork on it. But I think it sounds pretty good. I mean, it's amazing given these are
in general, The Deca Studio sound was variable, but generally pretty good and got better, I think, the longer they recorded him. It's important to talk about the music's evolution into what, you know, we call swing. And Armstrong is essential to that. And that's sometimes forgotten. I think maybe it's not forgotten. His role, his importance, the New Orleans to Chicago connection, his importance in beginning in Dixieland and then taking the music to a new place, that's often emphasized. But he's a seminal figure in the evolution of what we call swing. Maybe it would be useful here for maybe could you to say a few words about like what we mean when we talk about swing. Swing is a sort of subgenre of jazz, and much of the recordings we're going to talk about today, many of these recordings are paradigmatic examples of swing.
My heart gives a chill, I feel such a thrill, my feet won't keep still when they swing that music. Rhythm like that puts me in a trance, or you can't blame me for wanting to dance. From what I understand, it must be just grand to play in a band. When they swing that music, I'm just happy as can be when they swing that music for me.
What struck me the most about listening to this stuff again was, and I think, you know, my memory was, and I think that you've got two barriers to getting into Louis if you're not attuned to him already and you're coming at it from a more modernistic perspective. And one of them is, again, if you run across too many tired all-star performances, you're just going to miss. you can't just randomly pick out something by him. I mean, he's always good, but the best stuff is great. But I think the other thing is if you're used to listening for ears of kind of harmonic elaboration, what he's playing is going to seem simple. If you start listening to the rhythmic control he has, he is as fucking advanced as any player who's ever lived. And so when Mike's talking about swing, one way of thinking of it is you get away from that jaunty bouncing on a pogo stick, Dixieland or 30s jazz, you know, the cartoon cat walking jauntily down the road kind of stuff. And it's kind of a pogoing vertical sound to it to some degree, oompa oompa a little bit. And he horizontalizes that. I mean, his control of the time, roughly you could say is kind of a triplet feel over a 4-4, whatever. I mean, you know, but he's able to just float with absolute mastery rhythmically above what's being played. And it's just like he's on another plane. I mean, I always feel like when he comes in some of these songs, it's like you listen to the ordinary players playing solos or whatever, and then the camera lens snaps into focus, he starts playing, and everything is 200% sharper.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that just that for a second, right? So there's a lot of numbers on this that are, I don't know what I want to call them, call-out numbers maybe, where there'll be, you know, it'll be the group playing, and these are somewhat larger ensembles. So they're not, you know, five or seven guys, right? This is something more like Ellington-sized forces, 15, 16 players, would you say?
Sometimes,
right? We have a brass,
you know,
section,
sometimes a little
horn
smaller
sections.
But, you know, it's right. A more or less big band sound. It may not be the full complement of 16 every time, but it's a band. It's not a combo.
Right. So then on several numbers, so something like "What is this thing called swing?" or "I hope Gabriel likes my music," we get a kind of statement, and then we get some vocalizing by Louis, and then he calls on different players to sort of like "I hope Gabriel likes my music." He asks different members of the ensemble to play for Gabriel, right? The Archangel Gabriel, and they play. They do a little solo, right? And then he decides, all right, it's time for me to play, right? And when he plays, suddenly it's like, what the fuck just happened, right? It's not that the other soloists are bad. They're fine. They're good. It's just that he's such a dominant voice. When he starts to play, just by the sheer force of his playing, he often picks up the tempo. Like, everyone has to follow him. He goes faster than everyone else. It's like a shot of adrenaline or something when he starts to play, because his solos are as risky and inventive as anything that came before, but there's a sense of power and assurance and just speed with which he plays. And it's like he's not laying a solo over what the rest of the band is playing. He's playing a solo of such speed and magnitude and precision that he literally drags the rest of the ensemble in his wake. It's like the rhythm section picks up to keep up with him. He does it again and again and again. It's just like when he starts to play, everyone fucking snaps to attention and the pace picks up, right? And like you said, there's none of this oompa oompa stuff. When we say swing, we mean that he plays around with the beat, right? So he doesn't, the best example of a singer that I know of who is like the antithesis of swing would be Ethel Merman, if you've ever heard Ethel Merman sing.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything the traffic will allow.
Jeez. An amazing singer. She has a voice bigger than an opera house. But, you know, when she sings, there's no business like show business. I mean, she hits every fucking note exactly on the time. She doesn't hold anything over. She's just like, she's like a metronome. She is precise and on the note. And Louis could never play that. Like, he would never play, there's no business like show business. You know, be like, there's no business. You know, he would swing it. That's what we mean by swing. He plays fast and loose with the time so that he's aware of it, but he's not aping it or metronomically following along with it. He's going faster and slower, always aware of it and playing off and against it. And when he solos, that's, to me, that's the amazing thing. When he solos, he drags everyone in his wake. It's like everyone's like, now we play faster.
Or yeah.
How does that happen?
We're not saying that he's like a Dizzy Gillespie playing a fast solo, mm-hmm. in the sense of lots of technical passage work. I mean, his solos, again, I think the most amazing thing about them are the rhythmic construction, you know, and he's obviously getting purity of tone. But yeah, it's weird because like we associate him with the Dixieland style. That's what the Hot Fives and Sevens are sort of in. But his rhythmic playing is so advanced that it kind of dictates what the next style swing music would be. I mean, he completely is more rhythmically advanced than almost anybody in any swing ensemble for the next 15 years. He shows everything that can be done in that style almost immediately and keeps refining it. And then everybody else is just trying to scramble to catch up. So like when he's with Fletcher Henderson, he's teaching Coleman Hawkins basically how to play jazz rhythm, you know, how to swing. And, you know, Hawkins is always a little stiff. I love him. I mean, I think it's gorgeous music, but he's not somebody you turn to for lots of rhythmic fluidity, but you should have heard him before here, Louis. You
know? Yeah, he's not liquid. And would you say, I think it's probably fair to say, I mean, like Louis is the king of the eighth note. You're not going to hear a lot of 16th notes in his playing.
Yeah.
It's like, so when I say an eighth note, like a whole note would be you hold the note for the whole measure, right? And eighth note would just eight beats to the measure, right? Really fast players go significantly faster than that. I don't think he ever gets much faster than eighth notes, does he? I mean, he'll do triplets with them. He'll do little riffs, but you don't really hear him do runs the way that, say, you know, some insanely fluid trumpet player might pull off. That's not him. He's, you know, and yet somehow he has more power and more rhythmic energy than players who played at twice his speed.
Yeah, well, he's got amazing ideas. And talking about the style, it's, especially on these sides, he's, you know, if you listen to the Hot Fives and Sevens, he's a little rougher. I mean, he's not quite as just amazingly accomplished a player. I mean, he's amazing, but it's, you know, they're rough around the edges. There's occasional flubs. He's a little less predictable. You know, it's this kind of thing that, what the hell was that? You know, kind of stuff. And by here, listening closely, I'm thinking, is he improvising yet? Is he just paraphrasing? Well, he's paraphrasing. In other words, you rarely lose track of the melody that he's playing a solo over in his solo. But then I start realizing, well, how much of that melody really remains in it? And it's just, he has just completely brought alchemy to bear on it. I mean, many of the notes have been altered. The rhythms have been, again, just kind of raised to a level of sophistication unimagined by the original composer. It's just that he always is able to put enough landmarks in that you can kind of see the outline of that original, even as he kind of transcends it. It's not the sense of you play a melody, you play unrelated stuff over the same harmony, but it's just completely harmonic elaboration. It's always somehow tied into the material he's working with. It's just he's transforming it in ways that are a lot subtler and more profound than you realize at first. And again, if your ears are attuned to kind of 50s jazz, where for the most part, you pretty much leave that melody behind, it can seem in a weird way earthbound until you realize it's not. I mean, how much he's bringing to the table, how much he's changing things, how much he's adding to them. It's just that he doesn't want to lose track of the melody, even if he's not really playing it as closely as you think he is. Right. Just sort of like Billie Holiday. I mean, she's very much as a vocalist. I mean, you know, she would say that she's influenced by him, and it's that art of transforming a melody, but not abandoning it. You know, not just completely leaving it behind and coming up with something just completely different on the same changes. And in a way, I guess I'd say that, you know, going back to the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, one, I'm like, yeah, his playing is more startling and probably more brilliant on those tracks. They still somehow seem to me more archaic in that, you know, sometimes that clarinet player isn't a very good tune. And, you know, it is.
Right.
It's kind of rough and ready. It's still got those Dixieland roots. Whereas this stuff is just machine tooled. For the most part, the band is not fantastic, but I mean, they're very competent. And I keep thinking, yeah, is this the best swing music ever made? I mean, you know, if you hear the swing bands, the swing era, you know, Louis Armstrong's name doesn't come up. It's Benny Goodman, right, or it might be Duke Ellington, Count Basie. It might be Charlie Barnett or whoever, Artie Shaw. But I wonder, are these tracks, I mean, probably on a pound-for-pound basis, the bands aren't as good as some of the best swing bands. But then you add Louis, and I'm like, isn't the overall effect still bad? You know, he's just so good at this, you know. It's just like, man. So anyway, yeah, he's certainly somebody that, in a sense, invented the swing era. And then I guess mainly, if we think of bands as being swing bands as units, Louis was never really that dependent on or that interested in the band as a counterweight to him. It's more of a canvas or a background, I think. I mean, I know he calls people out, but it's only because he's going to steamroller them. I mean, it's not like he's looking
right.
to somebody for inspiration. He needs a frame kind of thing. That's the feeling I get from these singles, and really from most of what I've heard by him. I don't know if that sounds fair to you, but
that sounds about right. I would agree with you that the magic of the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens is that they're so raw. And sometimes, I mean, I don't want to knock the other players in the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, because some of them are quite good. Johnny Dodds on a good day is fucking unbelievable. Little Hard and Armstrong, his first wife, is probably never unbelievable. But Johnny St. Cyr on banjo is occasionally, you know, right? I mean, some of the people who were in that group, they have their moments. It's just that no one had moments on the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens like Armstrong. I mean, he did things that just people's jaw dropped open. You know, the stop time solos where he just doubles, you know, double times. It's you can just hear everyone else in the studio going, okay, we're just going to watch now.
Yeah.
You know, you can hear people go, okay, you just let us know, right? And, you know, the famous stories of him in those early recordings having to play outside the room, because if he played in the room with the other musicians, he was too loud. They'd have to back him up from the mic from everyone else. He was just so overpowering. These are way more polished than that. And I don't feel like there are moments of individual brilliance with the other players on these. I mean, they're not anonymous, but they might as well be in the setting that we're listening to them in. So, you know, pound for pound, there are probably fewer bad moments from these guys and many more pretty good moments. It's just that he still rises above whatever setting he's placed in.
Boy, grab your coat, grab your hat. Leave worries on doorstep. Just direct your feet on sunny side of the street. Can't you hear that pitter-pat? Yes, happy tune, your step, baby. Life can be so sweet on sunny side of the street. I just walk in shedding, baby, walk with those blues on red. I'm not afraid, yes.
I think maybe we should probably turn and talk a little bit about Louis as a vocalist, because by this period, he sings virtually on every song.
Yeah, that's true.
There are, you know, in the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, they discovered at a certain point that he had an amazing voice. But, you know, a lot of those songs are just musical numbers, and there's no talking, there's no singing. But by this period, he's known as much as a vocalist as he is as a trumpet player. He's got this uncanny gravelly, natural growl. It's not affected. It's just how he sounds. And he's actually a very good singer. Some people argue that he's the originator of scat or even some of the lingo of bebop, given the way he talks, given the way he sings on these songs. But he does vocally what he does on the trumpet. He swings the music. He does all kinds of, he has other tricks that he has as a vocalist that he doesn't do as often on the cornet. So on the cornet, he'll occasionally do, you know, smears and blurs and sort of falling away or rising up moments. But vocally, he does it all the time. Like, he's incapable of singing a straight lyric. The closest he gets on this entire set is the almost reverential treatment of the gospel song Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen, in which it's like he's a choir boy with his hands folded behind his back, singing with his eyes lifted to heaven. And that's the most subdued he gets. And even there, he's kind of an uncanny vocal presence, sort of singing softly and piously. For the most part, vocally, he's a raucous experience. And I love it when he doesn't even sing words, where he just like, blah, it sounds like he's vomiting on the mic. It's just fucking awesome. But it's always done in the service of the tune. He does it a few times, and I hope Gabriel likes my music.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Gabe. Me and Lil Sasmo gonna go up there and hit you some high ones. I know you wanna like this. Look, I said, let's swing one.
He's like, all right, boy, I'm going to play.
Yeah, right.
And then he just starts playing. What is that? I don't even know what that is. It's just him growling. And then he starts to play. And it's just fucking magical. So say some stuff about what you think about him as a vocalist. I was talking about the growling and the affectation, but we should actually talk about him as a fucking amazing singer as well.
Yeah, well, probably the case study for this would be the medley from Pennies from Heaven, right, where this whiter than white woman comes out and sings it, everything, you know, and then he comes and just, again, he is the master of paraphrase and the master of rhythmic variation and elaboration. And he makes that song something great. And then you get Bing Crosby coming on and Bing somewhere in the middle. Right.
Yeah. There's, you know, the Armstrong Crosby connection is a problematic one. Crosby is, he's a great singer. We should probably do a show on him one of these days. He's an important singer and also, you know, a world cultural figure of his era.
Sure, man.
He and Armstrong adored one another. Crosby put Armstrong in movies. He helped put him in feature films. The remake of The Philadelphia Story, which is not very good. It stars Bing Crosby in the Cary Grant role. So he's Dexter Haven, you know, good God. And Frank Sinatra plays plays the Jimmy Stewart role. And it would be fun to say that Louis Armstrong plays Katharine Hepburn, but he doesn't.
We can only wish.
Louis Armstrong is brought into the movie to play and sing, you know. He's Louis Armstrong. He's, in addition to being a great singer and a great player, he's endlessly photogenic. The camera loves him and he's wonderful on screen. Yeah, but the Crosby Armstrong thing is problematic. Crosby adored minstrel music and he adored blackface. And Crosby probably appears more often in blackface than any major film star, much more than you'd imagine. He does it a lot. I can rattle off five or six films Crosby.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're not good films, but you know, he thought it was wonderful stuff, and he thought it was wonderful stuff long after people thought this isn't wonderful stuff. He continued to sort of embrace it, and a lot of the numbers that he does when he does stuff live with Louis, or when he, you know, has Louis on his show, they're doing stuff like Mississippi Mud, which is really problematic. And Crosby blackens his voice when he sings these numbers. If he's not in blackface, he's loaded. It's horrendous. And there are some minstrelsy numbers on these decasides. And this is one of the things that gets Armstrong into bad water in the 50s and 60s, where people, you know, accuse him of being an Uncle Tom and his best pal is, you know, Bing Crosby, the whitest man alive, you know?
Well, no, Crosby was a pretty hip white guy, but he was a white guy.
Not to Miles Davis, he wasn't.
No, there you go. You're right. And, well,
no, I mean, I think he's plenty hip. I'm just saying, you sure. know, when you get to the 60s and Louis appearing on Bing Crosby specials, people are like, what the fuck, motherfucker?
Yeah, right. I think it's the old folks at home that, to me, with the Mills Brothers, because really, I mean, Bing only appears once here. I mean, but there are a couple minstrels, well, I don't know if that's the right word, but sort of quote-unquote Southern nostalgia songs that I assume are written by white guys, because I cannot imagine a black guy writing them, about how they missed life on the plantation, etc., African-Americans do. And yeah, that one, he seems to maybe complicated. The end, he gets almost, it's the only time I've ever heard Louis Armstrong sound actually ominous as opposed to joking around. I'm like, oh, okay, maybe there's a little something real coming through here.
Well, look over here. We are far away from home. Yeah, man.
But, yeah, there are a couple songs there that are really cringeworthy. And, yeah, I'd say overall, I mean, if you're a proud Hawaiian, you might be a little upset by some of the tracks that Louis does here.
Yeah, and I've always wondered about this. There's a period, when did Hawaii become a state? 48, 44, something? Well, I forget.
It predates that, the Hawaiian, I mean, this is all this 30s stuff, and there's...
There's a vogue for it. Crosby does album after album. He does a bunch of these Hawaiian albums, you know? The reason everyone knows the words to Mele Kalikimaka is because fucking Bing Crosby, Crosby made it a big hit.
There's just, it is a, the whole Pacific Island, I don't, you know, it just, there is a vogue. And it recurs, I don't know, I mean, to some degree, the Denny Martin Exotica stuff a little later is drawing from that well. But yeah, here, one way of looking at these singles, this massive five-hour set, would be to say there's certain kinds. I mean, there's the songs about music. There's a lot of songs just about, and the other, I guess one thing, when you mentioned him is singing, most of the time on these singles, Louis Armstrong is not singing great songs. They're really, it's not like this is a cool, and I'm really glad I don't really want to hear him singing Cole Porter, but these are not the top. There's a reason Tin Pan Alley doesn't sound like the fanciest location in the world. A lot of the stuff was kind of pressed out to order, and most of the songs he sings here are mediocre. Some of them are awful. There's a couple that are better than mediocre, but it's mainly Alchemy of Bad Stuff. But so they have several, like you said, Gabriel Likes My Music. My all-time favorite and one of my favorite tracks off this collection is The Trumpet Player's Lament.
Why do I have to play hot music? That's really not music. Why do they make me take part in it when I've no heart in it? Give me Debussy. I don't know what you see in jazz.
Where he's singing about, why do they make me play hot music? And I just want to play classical music. And it's just, it's a witty little song. It's got a very memorable, odd melody that may or may not be stolen from some classical piece. I don't recognize it. He's not camping it up or mugging much on it. And so it's even funnier because he's singing it more or less straight. And it's like the man who invents hot music and swinging, singing about how he wishes he didn't have to play it. It's just somehow cosmically amusing. And there's just several of these songs about playing in a band or the power of rhythm saved the world or music saved the world. You know, it's just a genre at that time. Right. There are songs about death. Old Man Moses dead, finding a dead body in the woods. You know, it's just, they're weird genres. Do people write songs about just, you're going to die, I'm going to die, I found this dead guy? I mean, it just seem like, it's like, again, like the Hawaiian obsession.
They don't have I'll Be Glad When You're Dead, You Rascal You, which is a classic Armstrong song. But it's a whole song about, you know, I'll be really happy when you die. That's the song, except it's this jaunty happy number. You know?
As long as you, there's like one, as long as you live, you're dead the day you die or whatever. And the Old Man Mows, which is an amazing performance. It's a great, catchy song, but it's about going out to this old guy's house in the woods and finding out that he's dead.
Right. One of my favorite songs about songs here. There's an endless complaint in jazz. Of course, people learn by imitating other people, and plenty of people, borrow from plenty of other people. Terrence Blanchard's career wouldn't be possible without Miles Davis, blah, blah, blah. Is it Blanchard who sounds like Davis? No, it's gone out of my head.
I'm thinking Wallace Roney, one? I think.
Roney, oh, Roney's shit. Oh, my God, Terrence Blanchard's the soundtrack guy. God damn it. Sorry, I take it all back. Yeah, Wallace Roney sounds like a lot like Miles, blah, blah, blah. So Louis's got, like, one of the earliest songs bitching about people stealing, right? Somebody stole my break, which is... It's a song about how someone stole his solo, and everyone in the band's like, was this the one? You know, they play some, like, and they're like, nah, that's not it. Then he plays his solo. But it's a wonderfully comic song about an early fact of the music, right? Everyone learns by stealing from everyone else and then pulling, like Taffy, what they've stolen.
And mainly stealing from Louis Armstrong, right? You know, it's
exactly. I mean, so many people, they heard those dates, those Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, they're like, that's what I want to do. And they imitate him, right? And so, yeah, it's a great song about complaining about, you know, theft in music very early. So that's with a smile on his face, of course, as always. When he does get serious, I do kind of like it. And I sometimes wish he was more often. But more often than not, it's the you get songs with the sort of crying behind the smile, right? What's the one? It's not on this set. Why Am I So Black and Blue? I forget. It's something like that.
Sure. That's a famous.
Yeah. And this on here, it's numbers like Solitude, which is a wonderful song. And he makes it seem happier than it is. Because you can hear some people sing Solitude and you think they're ready to die. But Solitude is a sort of very powerful, sweet number. And I've already called out Nobody Knows. The trouble I've seen, the way he sings that particular song is really kind of powerful. I think it's interesting, too, the way he, on this set, there are plenty of numbers where he revisits Hot Fives and Hot Sevens things. So West End Blues comes up in here, Mahogany Hall Stomp, and there's a few other numbers that are chestnuts from that period. And by this point, he's world famous and everyone knows those. So when he plays them, he doesn't just do his old stuff, right? Dipper Mouth Blues. He's reworking. He's not slavishly imitating his greatest hits. He's actually doing some new stuff that harkens back to the old, but shows him in a new setting. And he's doing different things than he did before, which is impressive, I think, because it would be very easy to just play your greatest hits by this point. And surely plenty of people wanted him to, and he doesn't.
Well, you know, like Strutting with Some Barbecue is, I feel like, probably more powerful in certain ways than the original.
Yeah.
Now, West End Blues, the cadence at the beginning of that became so famous that he does play it. And I think it doesn't quite have the lightning bolt power that it did on the earlier recording. And he is somebody that, we say this, but he is creative. He's a great paraphraser. At the same time, he is comfortable with the idea of a definitive solo or a solo that you might do variants on, but the basic outline is going to remain the same. Now, this is less. I mean, one of the great things about this collection is that there are so many oddities and attempts at different genres, as opposed to listening to a series. And again, there's some fantastic all-store recordings. I'm not trying to, you know, but there's a sense that when he got in the early 50s back in the all or came up with this All Stars format that kind of reproduced in certain ways of the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, and that became kind of his performing ensemble from there forward live. I mean, he did recordings in different themes, but that repertoire kind of shrank and shrank. Whereas here, She's the Daughter of a Planter from a Havana. It's a terrible song, but I mean, it's different. You get to hear him tackle. And, you know, some of the things work out better than others, but there's a wide range. When he comes back to his original hits, they're still pretty young, right? I mean, it's only been 10 years. And, yeah, there's still a freshness about his takes on some of those. I mean, you know, Strutting with Some Barbecue in this recording is pretty fucking unbelievable.
Yeah, it's probably my favorite cut.
Bye.
know, he's got the recording technology is 10 years better. I think the Decca Studios are probably a little better equipped than where he was for the Hot Fives, Hot Sevens. The band is slicker, if not more profound. And he is just an utter, he's not discovering, he is just mastered. And it's just like, right. Man, there is, you know, this effortless power. It's just like, he's doing things that would be impossible for most people. And he doesn't break a sweat anymore. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. He always broke a sweat. But handkerchief aside, he is just nails it, just effortlessly nails it. And yeah, they're just amazing displays of technique and just control. So yeah, in general, I think of him as somebody who finds things rather than as a searcher. He's a finder, right?
Right.
You know, he's not like a Coltrane who's just keeps trying to find the new thing, push himself, or even to some degree Miles, who, you know, maybe got more commercial towards the end, but was always trying to change. I think after a while, Armstrong's like, I'm Louis Armstrong. I'm my own genre. I don't have to, you know, kind of do that.
I am my own music.
So. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And, you know, he really stands out. So, yeah, that was definitely one of my favorites, too. What was another one? Another one of the Death songs was Poor Old Joe, this little story about this guy that died at 42 from his bad habit.
There's two cuts of that here.
Yeah, I don't whether they just took two shots at it. You know, I don't have the documentation with me, and it's pretty minimalist anyway. These were mostly the master takes. I think there are sets out there that will, you know, be more complete. And for the most part, I'm happy just to have – they're very listenable.
Right.
Except for the couple spoken word sermons he does, which...
I got something to say about that.
Okay, all right.
Well, so yeah, anyway, go finish your point.
Well, just, you know, Poor Old Joe, again, a slight song, a silly song, an odd song, and then it's just, this guy died. Again, I don't know if we have songs like that anymore. I don't know if we've had them since the 30s. But my God, again, just the performance on that, the momentum and the power is just awe-inspiring. So yeah, tell me about the sermons, because I got to admit, I kept skipping past those when they came up.
The elder is in bad humor this morning. Takes my text from the 11th of the Ecclesiastes. He that is amongst you without sin, let him throw the first rock. What it says is, let him cast the first stone. But I ain't taking no chances on you all misunderstanding me. For 20 years, you all been throwing rocks at one another. But you wasn't satisfied. You had to come and throwing them at me. Nothing.
Well, there's merit to them, but they're not. It's weird. So this is Louis actually shamelessly stealing from someone else. The Elder Eatmore character is a vaudeville character who was originated earlier by a Bahamian performer named Burt Williams, who had a partner through much of his career, a guy named George Walker. Williams and Walker were an early vaudeville pairing, and Williams had African ancestry, but he was very fair-skinned and had wavy hair, so to perform, he would go into blackface. How interesting, right?
Okay.
You know, partly African person doing blackface. And Elder Eatmore was a character that he developed, and he would do these comic sermons, and there were lots of them. There's a whole bunch of these routines. And so what Louis's doing is he's just stealing. He's stealing two of Burt Williams' gigs. And Williams, I believe, recorded a couple of these as well. So these weren't... This is Louis literally covering someone else. And the only thing that makes it, that redeems it slightly for me, is the tenor of his voice. I can listen to Louis read the phone book, and with the Elder Eatmore sermons, in some ways he kind of is reading the phone book. He's just doing someone else's comic routine of, you know, a sermon on one thing or another. And there's no someone eventually sings on the Throwing Stones track, I think, but they're not, these are vaudeville, these are comic vaudeville numbers. I don't know that it shows great taste on Louis's part to do these. And Williams and Walker were a complicated pair of dudes. Williams, he did perform in blackface. Having African ancestry, he's still blacked up, but he often performed against stereotype. He didn't just do coon stuff, you know, he actually sort of
stereotype,
some subversiveness. But I don't hear any of that in Louis' performance. Do you? It just sounds like he heard something someone else didn't. He does it. And, you know, I wouldn't say that it sets back race pride a decade, but it doesn't really advance it. Neither of the Elder Eat More numbers on this collection impress me apart from hearing Louis' voice. You could imagine this is the kind of thing that people who dug minstrelsy and blackface would hear and go, oh, yeah, that's cool. And it's the kind of thing that 30 years later made people irritated with Armstrong, I think.
Yeah, I read somewhere, and again, I'm not somebody that's been that into his biography. And of course, it was a major thing in that, again, he's kind of this American hero figure, right? But I read somewhere that, well, he kind of mistrusted religious authority. So there may have been that sense that religious hypocrisy growing up as he did, that he, you know, he didn't mind taking a swipe at that. But yeah, they don't seem all that inspired. Yeah, I mean, so much of this, it's even the singing, and I'm fascinated because people will talk about the deep emotion in his voice, and I think it's true. But to me, he's not a singer who disappears into a song. I mean, it's always Louis Armstrong singing that damn song, and it's about his amazing personality interfacing with the music. He's not a vessel. He is transforming what he sings all the time, though he's not ignoring it or deconstructing it or just, you know, taking away from it. With the spoken word stuff, yeah, he's got an amazing voice, but I don't know that he's not able to do that because it's, as you said, just kind of written out stuff. I just skip those two for the most part.
They're worth a listen because by the time he does them, Williams and Walker date from the turn of the century. Their heyday was 1900 to, say, 1920. So by the time Louis does this, it's actually a sort of time capsule view of something that's
right
20 years gone by the time he does it.
And probably not really much recorded.
Right.
Because of the era.
There are, you can get recordings of Burt Williams doing Elder. There are some singles of him doing Elder Oatmore. I don't know if there are YouTubes of it. That'd be worth, I could look that up real fast. But I know that I think he actually recorded for Decca, believe it or not.
And I assume, I don't know how these work. I assume it's an A&R man producing much of this material and Louis just Louifying it. I don't know that Louis's coming in saying, I want to do X, Y, and Z. He might just say, well, I can't or won't sing that. But for the most part, if so, then why did he sing on a coconut island?
Right.
You know, there's just some stuff in here that I think most of the time it's pleasant. Unless, again, you're a proud Hawaiian, you just wonder what's happened to your culture and why these things have been done to it.
Right. You get very unhappy with it.
And of course, moments. Yeah, there are, I don't think a lot, I mean, I guess a couple, you know, the motif of the frightened black man comes up a little bit here. Again, I think that the really offensive material for the most part is in a couple of these Mills Brothers songs, which again, to me, his stuff with the Mills Brothers is some of my absolute, and not because of that material, of course, but, you know, my walking stick or whatever, I just think are just gorgeous. I love it.
Right.
Just a weird contrast. I mean, they're singing along with him. One, it's like a guitar, his voice, their voices, which are also sometimes imitating, among other things, trumpets, which is just hilarious. And so it's him in a very minimalist setting. They have a certain kind of hipness. He is a very different kind and more profound kind of hipness. And it's just some amazing performances there, which I think I ran across on like a CD compilation years ago. And so I've grown up with those. And they remain some of my favorite stuff. But again, there's a couple songs there where you just, you know, at the time, you wonder, was this necessary? Was this a good idea? Are they taking the Mickey out of this stuff? I mean, do you want to sing about how happy the dark? I mean, Louis Armstrong grew up in New Orleans. He's not somebody who came from that background. He certainly knew racial oppression, but I mean, he wasn't. He was never nostalgic about being on a fucking plantation, you know.
Right.
As far as I know, neither were the Mills brothers. So there's this weird nostalgia that is so warped and so problematic. And then whatever it passed for in the 30s, listening to it in the 50s or 60s, God, much less the politically correct 2000 teens, it's just kind of hard to fathom. You know, why was this done? Was there no way of avoiding it? What is their attitude towards this material? But again, that's a couple tracks. And I'd say that, you know, if you're trying to get into this stuff, that's a place you can look, though you just kind of have to look up which tracks those are. You know, Gunther Schuller pulls out apparently four songs, Strutting with Some Barbecue, The Trumpet Player's Lament, Satchel Mouth Swing, and Jubilee. They're all from the same date. And he thinks, you know, picks that one out. And I would agree with him as like one of the highlights of this 5 hours of music, those four songs from that same date. They're all kind of amazing. And as I said, The Trumpet Player's Lament, I just, every time I hear it, I like it more. It's just amazing. And of course, Strutting with Some Barbecue is maybe the most amazing track on the whole collection. So that's another way of getting in. For the most part, I think these are grouped chronologically. So it's, you know, basically you'd have a date where you might record anywhere from 2 to 5 or 6 songs with the idea of releasing most or all of them on 78s. And then you'd have another session. And so the groupings change. I mean, he does, he's with Jimmy Dorsey's band at one point, and they do Dipper Mouth Blues, and I assume it's Jimmy playing the clarinet part there. So that's a little bit different from the usual band he's got on these tracks. I'm just kind of wandering around at this point. Not sure where we began.
Sorry. I was just looking up this, I was looking up the Burt Williams stuff, which is kind of interesting. And the only thing to say about it is, you know, we sometimes think that recording began with jazz as if nothing was recorded before Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, but recording had been around for a good 20 years before that. And so Williams and Walker made their name, made their money off their recordings. They performed in vaudeville, and eventually he made it into Ziegfeld's Follies. He was a cultural figure of some significance. He was dead by the time Louis had left New Orleans, although he overlapped with Louis in Chicago for a brief time. So maybe they knew each other. I don't know.
Well, of course, Ellington does a tribute to him. And, you know, I mean,
he's... Oh, really? Oh, that's right. That's right. But he doesn't do any other Oatmore sermons.
No, he yes. In a sense, one difficulty with this is instead of being presented with a few neat units, different artists, we're kind of just looking at this mass of stuff, and I knew that'd be kind of a question. But yeah, Louis is not, he does write some original lines, but he's not somebody that composes a lot of music. He transforms it, he jazzes it. I mean, literally, he is, you know, and it's not that he, you know, especially those Hot Fives, Hot Sevens, I mean, a lot of those are kind of worked up by the band, and some of those are Louis's, but, you know, I don't know that he's somebody we think of as a major composer or somebody we cover a lot, but this is everything he gets. In a sense, he kind of retools so completely it becomes his thing, even if he didn't create it.
Yeah.
In terms of just breaking the songs down, there are some ethnic ones. La Cucaracha is amazing.
Sing no matter where you are, the cucaracha, the cucaracha. Sing it on your guitar, the cucaracha, the cucaracha. Sing no matter where you are, the cucaracha, the cucaracha. Sing it on your guitar. But this much better, the boy didn't do better. But it has to say, but the boy didn't have to do the same.
There's a couple Mexican and a Cuban reference, but again, they are kind of filtered through the 30s hipster lens, right? They're not trying to be authentic ethnic musics by any stretch. They're just kind of referencing trends. And in a sense, this music, you know, the Hot Fives, Hot Sevens was kind of creating a cultural moment, not quite out of thin air, but taking the rough materials of Dixieland and just producing this new thing. This is, in a weird way, you get a sense of, like, what was going on in the zeitgeist in the 30s. I mean, Deck is just, like, throwing all the shit at him, and Louis hitting it all out of the park, but you get a sense that all these different genres of songs are just kind of a litmus test of what was going on in 30s entertainment, you know, and here's Louis taking it all on.
Yeah. For me, some of the best numbers aren't necessarily... So I absolutely identified Strutting with Some Barbecue as my favorite number here. It's the hottest number, and the soloing is ridiculous. But some of the most enjoyable stuff here is simply Louis' covers of what would pass for pop songs. And in every case, you can make an argument that he's given us the definitive early version of a particular song. There's a couple you might take issue with, right? His version of Ain't Misbehavin' versus, say, Fat Swaller. But there's a whole bunch of these songs that I think are wonderful. He takes a pop song and makes it his own, and they're special. It's not just the vocal treatments, of course. The playing is always superlative, too. But there's a whole bunch of these that, for me, are highlights, right? Ain't Misbehavin', Alexander's Ragtime Band,
yeah.
Baby, Won't You Please Come Home. I Can't Give You Anything But Love. I adore his treatment of that song. I think it's terrific. I'm in the Mood for Love, a very fine version of that song. I like his version of Jeepers Creepers. It's always fun to hear Louis do a song where he adapts the lyrics himself and he transforms them. Probably the most famous example is it's not on this set, but What a Wonderful World. He changes the words on the song just to things he can pronounce or things, you know, it's how he would pronounce something. So things get changed around. He sort of puts his own stamp on things. A couple other numbers like that. On the Sunny Side of the Street, a wonderful treatment of that particular song. I like Pennies from Heaven. Not the medley. I mean, I like the medley, but, you know, just his, there's a single version. The standalones is just fantastic here. It's just terrific stuff. So there's a bunch of these songs, When the Saints Go Marching In, that are singles, not perhaps necessarily associated with him initially, but his treatment is, if not definitive, then pretty damn important. It's something people have to reckon with when they come around to doing these tunes themselves.
Yeah, and, you know, there's also a second layer of, again, mediocre Tin Pan Alley songs that, you know, You Are My Lucky Star, not a good song.
No, it's a bad song.
When he sings it, it's almost okay. Now, he cannot say, if it's good, then I want it. That's just a fucking stupid song. Because I was thinking, you know, are there a couple here? And I guess, you know, there's the Oogie Moments with Mills Brothers. There's that. I don't by any means dislike the performance of West End Blues, but it seems just a little stiff. You know, that's one where you feel like the original's better. And of course, some of the singing on the Pennies from Heaven medley when it's not Louis is just kind of, or, you know, I mean, Bing is okay, but whoever that white woman is, I mean, wow. It's a reminder that, and there's some other medley from some other movie, and it's just like these people you want to shoot. And then he sings a brief excerpt from The Skeleton in the Closet, which is a stupid song, but still fun when Louis sings. You know, it's like, oh my God, someone with talent, finally. But mostly, I think it's this is just a very playable collection. I mean, there's just most of it is fun, and most of it is at a really high level of his playing and singing, even if the material isn't that great. And as I said, there's something to be said for the weird, wild, wacky variety of stuff he's doing. It's just so out of left field, some of these songs. And he saves almost every one of them. I don't think you can save if it's good that I want it. But yeah, it's you can't really go wrong with this stuff. I wouldn't start here, but in a weird way, I think in some ways this is more accessible for me anyway. Just as a listening experience, just stick it on, play it for a while. Than even the Hot Fives and Sevens, just because, again, the sound's a bit clearer, the band's a little bit more quote-unquote professional sounding, even if they're not as inspired. Louis is just, he's like this Cadillac with 50 cylinders rolling down the highway, just imperturbably great. But the greater music is on the Hot Fives and Sevens. I mean, you can listen to it. But just in terms of, I guess, you know, challenge or just digestibility, This is not as raw. This is not as, you know, elbows out. So yeah, just a lot of treasures here. And again, for me, I'm more likely to cue this up than just a random All-Stars Day. Just because, again, as brilliant as he is when he plays Basin Street Blues for the 957th time, it's my own fault. If I did nothing but listen to Louis, I'd know how to, like, absorb that. But since I don't, I kind of want to get to the fun, good stuff and the different stuff.
Right. Perhaps the best example, and you can, folks can, YouTube is your friend here. If you can't lay out for one of these box sets, just YouTube or Spotify, you can find all these deck of things. They're widely available. I was just going to riff on your point about Louis transforming material. I can't remember the name of it, and I think I've talked about it here before, but I recently watched a not very good jazz film called Syncopation, and it's about the moment where jazz leaves New Orleans and comes to Chicago, right, and becomes and gets white. And the white jazz player here, so the Louis Armstrong player is played by, I want to say, Rex Stewart. I think he's actually in the film.
So this is a pretty old film. I mean, this is not...
It's from 42. It's by William Dieterle. So the African-American, his name is, in the film, he's called King Jeffers, and he's played by Rex Stewart, and he's slash Louis Armstrong slash King Oliver, right?
Sure, yeah.
And the white guy, the Bunny Berrigan figure, I don't know, is played by that titan of acting, Jackie Cooper.
Okay.
He's Johnny Schumacher, and he's this white guy. The film is also noteworthy because it has, among other people in it, Connie Boswell, Harry James, Gene Krupa, Joe Venuti, they're all in the movie. Charlie Barnett, Benny Goodman, they're all in the film, right? So that's kind of interesting. So anyway, on the DVD that I watched of this film from 42, and it's about the moment when, you know, jazz makes it from New Orleans to Chicago. That's what the film is about. And it's okay. It's not terrible. It's not brilliant. The DVD had a bunch of filler videos, some of which you can find on YouTube. And my favorite is one starring Louis Armstrong. And I think I've talked about this before. I think it's part of a 15-minute video called Rhapsody in Black and Blue, which is about Ellington. And it actually has Ellington and the band performing. It's got the brilliant Freddie Washington, blah, blah, blah. Fine. There's an opening bit to this, and it stars an African-American janitor and his wife. And she wants him to get to work, and he's listening to Louis. He's listening to the record, and he's trying to play drums on his wash tub. And he's broken off his mop, and he's trying to play drums. And his wife yells at him to stop that, or she's going to hurt him, and he just ignores her. And so she hits him upside the head with something heavy, and he passes out, and he wakes up in Jazzmania. And Jazzmania, it's amazing. You need to look. You can just look up, I think it's under Louis Armstrong, Jazzmania. It'll come up under Rhapsody in Black and Blue on YouTube. But it's like 5 insane fucking minutes where Louis Armstrong, dressed in an African, he's dressed in a one-shoulder leopard print robe, sings and then plays for the king of Jazzmania, who is now the janitor. He's on his throne. And someone got very high when they made this, because the janitor, who's the king of Jazzmania, he is sitting on his throne, and Louis is singing and playing, and he's fucking sublime in the most stupid setting you could possibly... I mean, he's wearing this fucking stupid... Like, he's a savage from the jungle. It's really, really offensive. And in the meantime... Throughout the entire, this is a very large set for this film. There are bubbles because you see the janitor got knocked out and sort of fell with his head in the bucket. And so there are increasing amounts of bubbles as the scene. So Louis is standing up to his waist in bubbles on a giant set with tons of bubbles. And he's playing incredibly hot, fast stuff. And in spite of all the stupidity going on around him, it's sublime. I mean, you just, if you shut your eyes and listen, you're like, wow, this is amazing. If you open your eyes, you're like, I can't unsee that. It's just simply amazing. Are you looking it up? It's just amazing.
Haven't succeeded finding it, but yeah, no, it sounds, and this is the thing. He's such a huge figure, right? I mean, he's multimedia extravaganza back in the 20s and 30s.
Louis Armstrong, A Rhapsody in Black and Blue, go to video and it'll come up on YouTube. It's 10 minutes long and it is spectacularly offensive.
Poor old Joe has been buried to his fate. For old Joe is knocking Peter's gate. I can see the smile upon his face when he takes his place with the angels. Angels, for old Joe, he was only 42. Didn't know the things he shouldn't do. Now he's through, that's why the bells are ringing. Everybody singing for poor old Joe.
You know, a lot of people have in the past dismissed this period of his career, and they prefer either, obviously, the brilliant Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, or the music he made immediately after that, which is also pretty fantastic, which included some early big band stuff for OK as opposed to Decca. Or they like the All-Stars because he goes back to his roots. But I'm saying that you don't want to miss this weird stuff from the 30s on Decca, because there's just a lot of gems here, and it's just fascinating. I mean, again, just what a song could be about just seems to be completely in play at this time with these weird trends and obsessions and just experiments. And a lot of it's not in the best taste, and some of it's in horrible taste, but this is fascinating. This is a fascinating document. I almost always entertaining, occasionally just disturbing, but you know, 95% of the time it's just amazingly perform stuff, even though, again, most of the material he's covering has no intrinsic great merit. There aren't many great songs on the, you know, as songs. It's just there are so many great performances.
Yeah, I mean, that's, like I said, he even on the most retrograde material, he brings something to it that he's got a charisma and he's got a style that, you know, you can't take your eyes off him. And he elevates material that you would think there's no way that this could be raised at all.
Can be and saved. Yet, can the song right. be saved? Come in, Dr. Louie.
It's hard to describe the effect of watching him sing Shine in a leopard print robe with his cornet in hand as bubbles begin to mount around him.
Yeah, but again, just as oral treats, there's amazing stuff here. And right now, for whatever reason, if you really wanted to buy the MP3s, you could. They're like $60 on Amazon. You can stream them. So it is available in an organized way, in a way that I'm guessing 2 or 3 years ago it wasn't. I'm not trying to pimp it. I'm just saying that if you wanted to hear it, don't buy the definitive box that we listen to, because people on Amazon want hundreds of dollars for it, which is ridiculous. Well, that's just stupid. But, you know, the music is out there. So anyway, we don't mostly talk about modernistic stuff. I think the plan next time is to actually talk about some of his near contemporaries. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Well, they're going to do 4 horn players not named Louis.
From that period.
From that era, roughly that era. Yeah. So some will be really early and some will be from this era, you know, the 20s and 30s. So we'll do a couple of...
Cool.
And we bitch and moan sometimes about Wynton Marsalis, but if he's done nothing else in his career, and God, he's done so much, actually, he's terribly important. He's insisted, he's always championed the importance of Louis Armstrong, and one may get irritated at times with how loud he gets about the neo-traditionalist agenda, but thank God there's someone out there who just keeps saying, oh, don't forget this. This is incredibly important. You know, he's always been, from the beginning until now, one of the most vocal, loud champions of this period of this music. I'm sorry, Wynton, come home.
Mama, take this badge off me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
All right, well, any pop matters on your mind? Do you want to talk about the Brian Ferry stuff or not? Or?
Oh, sure. The Brian Ferry stuff is fun. I like it. You know, people, I think it's fascinating. Brian, you know, I was reading reviews and a lot of people were shitting on the idea of him doing a Bob Dylan album on account of the fact that So we're talking about Dylan-esque and Olympia. And a bunch of people were shitting on him about doing that because, what is it, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall was sort of a really important song for him, right? Back in the day. You know, if Bob Dylan is going to be Frank Sinatra, why can't Brian Ferry be Bob Dylan? I really don't have a problem with this.
Well, of course, this happened earlier before Dylan started doing things to the Great American Songbook that should be reported to the courts. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't have a problem. Ferry has always been an interpreter. His instrument was always limited. Let's put it that way. And now that he's older, I think it's limited in it continues to be limited, but in interesting, different ways. So I enjoyed the hell out of this. I thought it was fine. Some of the songs, I wouldn't say I like them better than Dylan's, but I think they're worthwhile takes. I can never hear enough different versions of Knockin' on Heaven's Door. I just love that song.
Yeah.
I can hear it again and again. I don't care who does it. I love hearing it. There are some songs on there that I don't like as much. I'm not particularly enamored of his version of All Along the Watchtower. on this outing, but then other songs I think his voice is just right for. I love his versions of Simple Twist of Fate and Make You Feel My Love. I think they're terrific. Baby Let Me Follow You Down, that's okay. Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues, okay. So you know, I don't have a problem with him interpreting Dylan, and I was reading reviews, and if you go and Rate Your Music, there's an arc on all reviews on Rate Your Music, both for films and for music, which is the earliest reviewers are always the most positive, right? There's like 5 stars. Oh my God. Ferry transforms still. This always happens, right? Whatever the film is, Avengers is the greatest film ever. And then the haters come in later, and the truth is usually somewhere in between. And so, you know, if you look at Rate Your Music's ratings for this, oh my God, the last reviews are just devastating. This just seems over the top to me. I don't have any problem in principle with him doing these. And the thing is, he's a distinctive vocal presence. So he's not just going to do Bob. Yay. That's okay. You like it or you don't. I actually kind of like it. As far as Olympia goes, I don't know how you feel about Olympia, but some things here are very good and some things aren't. It does sound like earlier Ferry solo work being refiltered. What's the one? Bette Noire. It sounds a lot like Bette Noire to me on a whole bunch of songs here. Okay, fine. It's dance music, and you can totally see how this would get remixed for clubs. Like this is stuff that's meant to be remixed, and there's meant to be extended cuts of it for chic European clubs where white people still go to dance and do coke. Okay, fine. That's a niche, and Brian Ferry owns it. I kind of enjoyed it. I didn't think it was great. I didn't think it was terrible. Do you like him or what?
Well, I have not dug into Dylan-esque yet. My guess is there is that for a lot of baby boomers, music sort of starts in 1963. And
right.
Dylan is this kind of sacred totem you're not allowed to touch. As Generation Xers, I don't know that we take him quite with that degree of seriousness. Not that I've got anything against him or think he's not a great artist. Just, I mean, but he's not like, you know, the thing that you cannot touch. And of course, we both like music a lot older than that, which baby boomers often don't. You know, they just think it was everything before the Beatles kind of sucked. It wasn't real, man. So, yeah, I'm guessing some of that obsessiveness is in there. And then, yeah, Ferry, I mean, I think Ferry is he's a rare example of a rock singer who does have interpretive chops. I mean, somebody who really, in certain ways, not in technique or sound exactly, but just in his nuanced take. I mean, it's somewhat stylized, but there's still some nuance there, you know, can transform a cover and make it his. And he does it in kind of wild, over-the-top, cartoony ways on These Foolish Things, his first solo album, which is just one of my all-time favorites. And then once you've heard him, I cry if I want to. It's kind of a life-changing experience. I disturbed a class of kids with that about 20 years ago, playing it for them. They wanted to crawl under the table. It was so disturbing. And he's done an album of standards now, and he's also turned his own music into 30-sounding jazz. I think we talked about that project probably 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's he sees himself, and I think rightly, as somebody in that tradition. I mean, now he's not got huge amounts of vocal equipment, but then, you know, he's not as profound as Billie Holiday, but his voice is probably as quote-unquote good, you know, right? I mean, it's, again,
yeah.
it's, It's not super powerful, not a huge range, but it's all about curveballs and whatever and style. And sometimes it gets a little bit ossified. I say Olympia to me, I had that weird experience of listening to it and both recognizing it but not quite recognizing it. And it's like, oh yeah, this is not a Brian Ferry album I've played dozens of times before. I sort of feel like it, is it? No, it's not. It's new. Wait, am I supposed to know this? You know, so yeah, I don't think it's got a real distinctive identity apart from the brand he kind of established in his later career. It's maybe a little more forceful, a little more edge to it than some of his stuff. You know, a little perkier than Momoa or something. Basically, it was cheap, as was Dylan Askin, so I picked it up at a used record store in Malmer. I thought, well, I don't have these Brian Ferry albums. They're the only ones that I'm aware of, so, you know, if they're $5 a piece, I'll get them. It's interesting to see the baby boomers defending their sacred ground from, I don't know, a rough contemporary, really.
Yeah, they're the same, almost the same damn age, and Dylan is as stylized a singer, if you want to call him that, as Ferry in some respects. Dylan's probably a better singer now than he was when he started. It's not all through the nose now. He actually, you know, has a little sustain, a little vibrato. So why bitch about that?
Right, but I think that for many people, Dylan was a Vedic, prophetic, cosmic voice,
right,
dictating the truth of the 60s. And then Ferry's always been a removed, stylized, somewhat ironic, devilish figure,
right,
especially early on.
He's a coked up, ironized dance version, you know, and the people are like, no, that's the antithesis of authenticity. You know?
Right, the inner cover of Roxy Music's debut album, ruined many lives. And yeah, it's as far and away from the sincerity of Dylan saying the times are changing as it's humanly possible to get. But yeah, ultimately, are they that far apart? Not really. You know? Ferry's become more of a romantic in his old age, but you know, still with that kind of, I don't know, dark undercurrent. And yeah, now Dylan's doing standards, you know.
You must think that I'm stupid. You must think that I'm a fool. You must think that I'm new to this. But I have seen this song before.
I have other stuff to discuss. You probably have other stuff to discuss too. A couple of things recently acquired. Probably have more to say about them in the future, but I have just, you know, hot takes on two new things. So my ongoing quest to know what my students are listening to, I've recently picked up In the Lonely Hour by Sam Smith.
Oh, okay.
Why are you enthusiastic?
I read about it. I don't know that I like it. I mean, I haven't heard it, but I just, it's like, oh, okay, well, that seems to be a topic of discussion. So what is Sam Smith up to?
Sam Smith, so he's, some call this blue-eyed soul. He sounds uncannily like Anthony of Anthony and the Johnsons. Actually, it's not Anthony anymore. It's Anon. I'm going to mispronounce it. It's Anon. The lead singer of Anthony and the Johnsons is she, and she goes by Anon. I'm going to mispronounce it.
The Johnson is gone now. Right. Okay.
Don't be glib. Anonyi, spelled A-N or A-H-N-O-N-Y-I. I don't know how that's pronounced.
And there's some beautiful music on those recordings, right?
Oh, God. Just an amazing voice. And just, you know, the voice that Morrissey wished he had. That's a voice of aching, tortured lament. I mean, to me, that when I adore several, I have three of those albums, and I think they're fantastic. I the lyrics I don't always like, but you can't fault the performance. I mean, it's operatic in the best sense of the word. So anyway, Sam Smith sounds a lot like Anthony to me.
Oh, okay.
But without nearly as much gravitas, pathos, or sincerity. So my initial hot take here is, yuck, why do 14-year-olds find this interesting? Oh, wait, they're 14-year-olds. Now I know. So anyway, if this is Blue-Eyed Soul, God help us all. I don't know. I might like it more after I listen to it more. And then I picked up Sia, another one named performer. Sia from her album, it's like 4 years ago, 1,000 Forms of Fear. And where I know Sia from, I know her from literally one place, which is the brilliant series on HBO there for a while. The one about dead people. Fuck.
6 Feet
Under, thank you.
Okay.
The sublime, still to my mind, maybe the best ending of any show ever. Six Feet Under had the best concluding episode fucking ever. And it was an epic show. It was brilliant from beginning to end.
Okay. I've never seen it, but I know about it. I mean, yeah, okay.
Oh, it is sublime. And the final episode is just get the handkerchiefs. You're going to, I'm a grown up man and there's no water in this rock. And I cried like a fucking baby. It's torn up. And the final episode is the final montage is done to a Sia song. Mm. So I've always, and I may be mispronouncing that. And I think also she does the song for the show Luther, the opening credits song. That's her as well. So she's got this sort of haunting, groovy, cool voice. So I sort of picked this up just because I thought, well, I should own an album of hers and see what it's like. And I'm still coming to terms with it. Still trying to make up my mind. It does have, I think, one of the best sets of ironic artwork ever. So the cover of the album, it shows this sort of platinum blonde short, it's not a pixie cut, it's a little bit longer than a pixie cut wig, presumably a wig that Sia herself might wear, but it's just the wig and you don't see the face. And then the booklet with all the pictures, and these are all songs about women, right? I mean, and different kinds of, here's the titles of some of the songs: Big Girls Cry, Hostage, Burn the Pages, Elastic Heart, Dressed in Black, Straight for the Knife. So, okay.
Uniformly happy is what you're saying. Louis Armstrong, I love every one of them. Okay.
There are sort of feminist laments in pain about masculinist forms of stupidity, which, more power to her. That's fine. All of the pictures are of people wearing these wigs, and the people are all men dressed in hot chick outfits, except they're all sort of portly and middle-aged with like 5-day growth of beards, but they're wearing this fucking wig. And I want to
tell
brilliant.
You that photo shoot was hell. The lights were so hot. I'll never do that again.
You know, they're like, they're all wearing outfits that you would expect like sure. a girl pop singer to wear. And I'm like, this, she wins the award for the best cover booklet ever. I was like, this is fucking brilliant. You see the ridiculousness of these poses and these clothes when it's sort of schlubby guys wearing that wig and wearing a mini dress in heels, sprawled on a bed with their mouth half open. And you're like, right. It's really effective. I just thought it was brilliant. Still coming to terms with the music. There's a little autotune, I think, and you know how I feel about that. I think she has a good voice on the singles I've heard, so I'm kind of wondering what happened there. I don't know. I'll let you know when I've heard it a few more times. But the one I really want to talk about, because I just think he's fascinating, is Ed Sheeran. Do you know who Ed Sheeran is?
Yeah, I know who he is. I hear about him. I don't listen to him. Don't know any of his songs.
Someone hooked me up with Ed Sheeran a few years ago, and my God, he's fascinating. He's a little round ginger, and the poor fellow, he's balding. He's like probably in his late 20s now, but he's going full Elton John fast, and he's kind of portly, tubby, roundish. So I feel sorry for him. He's sort of this cherubic face. Anyway, he's kind of a folky with a guitar who raps. And he's got a good flow. He's fast. So this the album I'm talking about that I've recently re-listened to here is X. Mm. And that's literally the word. The name of the album is the letter X. Fine. And it's got a bunch of songs on it that I like that are pretty good. Take It Back. There's a song here. I forget the name of it. But the chorus is, I don't love you. I don't need you anymore. It's pretty bleak shit. Anyway, when he gets into his little rap flow, he's pretty good. He's got some nice rhymes. He's got a really good rhythmic flow. But I've never heard a singer spend so much time in his songs. You know how like a lot of rap stars, a lot of people who do this, there's a lot of boasting, right? Sexual boasting.
Sure, sure.
Sexual boasting, whatever. Or, you know, diss songs of other people. Ed Sheeran doesn't do any of that. His raps are all about how hard he works. It's like the Protestant work ethic hip hop album. He talks all the time about how busy he is and how, you know, if he doesn't keep working, people will forget his name. And like, it's like he's running really fast to get somewhere. All of his raps are about how hard working is. And there's not time for a life and not time to be with all of his friends and not time to have a girl and have a home of his own. And it's just because he's working so hard and he's so busy and he's always in the studio or he's always on tour. Like, I've never heard a rapper spend so much time talking about what a hard worker he is. It's like I'm the worker bee.
Are you saying that Bachman Turner Overdrive is lying to me? Those sons of bitches.
I it's just weird to hear like a rapper, you know, talking about how busy he is, you know, like he's, you know, I've got things to do. I've got people to, you know, it's not, I gotta lay back in the limo and smoke another blunt. It's like, I gotta be in the studio. I'm working on my lyrics. I don't have time to be with. It's just one song after another about how hardworking he is. It's unique. It's funny. I don't know if it's not meant to be funny. It's meant to be serious. So you're meant to sort of feel the tragedy of his life that he can't have these things because he's so hardworking. But I sort of just feel like Snoop Dogg should walk up to him and say, yo, bro, take a hit.
There you go. Yeah, I should listen to all those artists. I'm aware of them. They're part of the cultural conversation. I kind of, you know, the names are familiar. I think Sheeran's aren't all of his, like, mathematical symbols or something, plus and minus and what, but I don't listen to them. And you know, this was one of the issues with this performance. I have to find a time that I could listen to music with words, because if I'm going to listen to it, I'm going to pay attention to it. So yeah, and I guess the only thing for me to capstone things is that, you know, I talked about the Beatles a lot last episode, and since that time, and of course now several weeks in the past, apparently Quincy Jones has some things to say about them. So they're interviewing him, and he's kind of a, you know, don't give a fuck time of his life. So he just kind of tore into, I guess he was involved with some session on one of Ringo Starr's solo albums, and said the guy just couldn't play this 4-bar break, so we sent him to the pub and brought in a jazz musician who took care of it in 15 minutes.
Ouch.
But I mean, it's funny because to me, that's just two different conversations.
Right.
Anybody that knows about music, which I guess is a fairly small percentage of people, could tell you that, you know, most jazz musicians are better instrumentalists, masters of their craft playing, than any Beatle. But that wasn't the point of the Beatles, right? And he was saying he thought Paul McCartney was a terrible bassist. That seems odd to me. Now, I don't know whether McCartney's known for the melodic bass lines. Now, whether you can put McCartney in a group and he can just play brilliantly the way a great jazz bass player would, or one of the great funk players. I don't know. I don't know. I haven't listened to like a lot of live Wings music, because life is short. That's not what I want to hear.
But that seems excessive. Of the four, he and Harrison, I always thought were the two most music, just pure
right, musicians.
Talents, musicians. Yeah. And I mean, no one's saying that he's a Stanley Clark or whatever, but he's a better than competent bass player in a rock setting. He's actually pretty good, I'd say. That seems harsh.
Well, and you know, and really, again, known for bass lines that had compositional or melodic interest, you know, as Brian Wilson was. And Brian, I actually had other people play them, really good studio musicians like Carol Kay, rather than, I don't think it was him very often, but I mean, he'd write them. I don't know. It was just interesting. I mean, because it's the Beatles, it gets coverage. It just may be this long sense that, again, one of the great baby boomer idols, and I love their music. But yeah, if you asked me, do you love the Beatles because they're the four greatest instrumentalists in the world? I'd look in your face, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And that concludes episode 135 of the Jazz Bastard podcast. We hope you enjoyed our podcast on Louis Armstrong's earlier Decasides. If you'd like to hear a little bit more about Bert Williams, the vaudevillian performer, I'm including a little bit more of Mike's discussion of him at the end of this podcast. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com, pat@jazzbastard.com, our Facebook page, or if you want to drop me a message, you can send it to All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com or from Apple Podcasts. Tune in next time as we discuss five musicians who worked roughly the same time as Louis Armstrong in the early period of jazz. We'll be discussing Henry Red Allen, King Oliver, Bunny Berrigan, Papa Celeste, and Sam Morgan. Until next time, take care. The moon's descended, but it's found at the break of dawn.
Williams and Walker were a complicated pair of dudes. Williams, he did perform in blackface. Having African ancestry, he's still blacked up. But he often performed against stereotype. He didn't just do coon stuff.
Right, didn't reinforce the stereotype, yeah.
And supposedly, the most famous act that he and Walker did together was, you probably heard about cakewalks, these sort of public forms of walk dancing that were much admired by white folk. And cakewalks was a kind of it's really hard to describe them now. I mean, it's a sort of form. It's an appropriated form of African American self-presentation. Let's put it that way. That's kind of the kind way of putting it. And apparently, Williams and Walker were much given to mocking whitey when they did cakewalks. So they would do these examples as white people. They would imagine how white people would do them, and white people, they don't have the same swing, they don't have the same panache or showmanship. So there can be, in some of this, you know, blackface vaudeville material, even when performed by African Americans, there can be some satire here and some subversiveness. There's a funny story about Poe Williams and Ziegfeld Follies. When he got into the show, sort of a variety act, other members of the show complained to Ziegfeld to get rid of Burt Williams, because they're like, they didn't want his low class minstrelsy. They didn't want any of that around. It's a high toned show. And Ziegfeld famously said, "I can replace every one of you except him." So, it's like, all of you do things that I can find someplace else. He doesn't do anything that anyone else does.